right. Hey, everybody, it's Eric, and thank you for joining us for another Hatchet Cast episode. And today I have a very special guest with me, Brian. And Brian is an awesome human being. He's also in the medical field when it comes to medicine for the mind. And we're going to talk a lot about preparedness, but also mindset and some psychology type stuff. So if you haven't done so already, please go ahead, hit the like and subscribe button, subscribe to our channel. We have all of our guest only episodes, as well as our YouTube channel and Instagram. It really helps us out a lot. But without further ado, Brian, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me again.
Yeah, absolutely. I knew we had to do it again. So this is round two. I think actually your episode was episode 12, but if you guys go look back, you can kind of search through the episodes and listen to the first one. But yeah, for those who are listening to you for the first time, go ahead and give a quick intro on yourself and your background. And yeah.
Sure. So I am a licensed psychologist, and now I work in my private practice. I primarily see folks who struggle with anxiety and some depression, but a lot of times like relationship issues. I think part of my experience is that I think it's actually kind of cool in the world of psychology of working in different environments. And so I've been able to work in things like forensic assessment. So people are ordered by the court system for whatever reason to have an assessment for their mental health. Maybe they committed a crime and, you know, are they fit to stand trial or stuff like that. I've also been able to work in college counseling, which has been a really eye-opening experience for the state of what it's like to be a college student and that kind of thing. So I feel like I've had a bunch of diverse experiences, but ended up in private practice, which is a good fit for me now.
Nice. How long have you been in the field?
I think I saw my first client in 2008, so 16 years. But that, wow, that included a lot of my training too, but you would see people while you're in training. Yeah.
For some of the criminal cases, were you able to see kind of the darker side of humanity working some of those cases as far as?
Yes.
Wow. Yeah. Would you like to go into some of that or?
Yeah, sure. I think I can.
You can kind of general rule of thumb.
Yeah, obviously in this field, it's really important to, you want to protect people's confidentiality, right? And so these are actually public cases, so there aren't necessarily confidential limits, but I can talk about cases in such a vague way that it wouldn't be breaching anybody's confidentiality. But I think the cases that are weird, so there's a bunch of them actually that stick out. But what's striking is when you're not just having a conversation with somebody that's maybe done a horrific crime, but you're actually kind of like asking them specific questions. You know, you're doing an assessment, so you're trying to figure out, you're giving them tests and see what their scores are. And so what's kind of interesting, probably people would be more interested to hear of some of the off the side stuff, because the testing is interesting, but the side stuff is like, what are the like tricky clinical interview questions that you might ask somebody to figure out, like, how do they think or how do they see the world? And so for somebody who, for example, it would be common to have somebody who had committed pretty awful child abuse, and they come in for this assessment that's trying to figure out, you know, A, should they ever have access to their kids again? Or if we do think that's possible, like, what would be some good reasonable steps? Or what, most often it's they just need training. Like, they aren't equipped to have good parenting training and they need that. But some people should never be around children. And so if you get a feel like for somebody with a lot of narcissism and they're a parent and they let's just say they're awful to their kids and they are physically abusive, it'll show up on the testing, but you can do in the clinical interview, you're going to ask stuff like, what's the name of your kid's school? Maybe they know it, maybe they don't. What's the name of your kid's teacher? What grade are they in? How are they doing in school? If someone is struggling with narcissism, they're going to really struggle to answer those kinds of questions, because even though as a parent, if you're involved in your kids' lives, you're going to know where their school is. You're probably going to know the teacher's name, at least one of them. If you're struggling with narcissism, you don't pay attention to that kind of stuff, because that's not how you think. And so, like, just if you don't, if anybody listening, if you don't know the name of your kid's school, you doesn't mean you have narcissism. But it's like one of the things you're kind of listening for of like, what do you know about your kid's life? Like, what are you paying attention to? So that kind of stuff. But there's awful cases. I did an assessment once for, it's actually really sad. She was like a 12 or 13 year old girl, and she had, I'm going to be vague. She had committed a pretty awful act of violence. And I was talking to her and I said, you know, what made you want to do that? Or what happened? And she said, I forgot the name of the show. It was Dean. She said, Dean from Supernatural told me to do it.
I've had bad feelings about that show. Not going to
lie. Oh, really?
I watched it for a couple seasons. And I remember it was pretty easy to watch, like, oh, this is kind of cheesy. But as the seasons kept going on, I kept feeling I kept feeling nervous. Like it would actually start to make me scared after watching the show. I think because I was, you see all these things and it starts training yourself to be in a state of fear. But anyways, go ahead.
Well, just that but you're talking about it in a way that's kind of like different from other shows that might be disturbing in some way.
Yeah.
There's something unique about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't remember if she elaborated it much beyond that, or I don't remember, but she definitely had some unfortunate psychosis that was coming. She wasn't a bad kid, you know, she had a mental health issue and it's like, she doesn't want to be a bad kid, but when your brain isn't working right, you do some awful things.
Man, that's, you know, it's kind of interesting to see, like, I watch a lot of those, you know, I'm sure a lot of folks do those shows where it's like a serial killer or whatever, and kind of their upbringing.
Yeah.
You kind of see the steps that led to it. Like it was like, hey, they could have been a normal child, but because of traumatic experiences in their childhood or exposures that were improper at a certain age and stuff like that, what they're exposed to, led them down this road, almost like where, you know, the human mind became broken and these are a side result or, down the road, an after effect of that. Yeah, I think of like, for example, in the war in Ukraine, one of the things that kind of really stands out to me is some of the atrocities that happen on both sides. Like, what causes a human being to do something as not just obviously war, that's just the natural state of things, but the drastic thing of executing an unarmed person or doing something, pretty much murder, you know, what causes them to go into that state of murder? Do you think that psychopaths or people who fit that bill are born, or are they pretty much created because of circumstances in their life? Or is it 50-50?
The research would say that, speaking of generalities, we could even sort of generally talk about personality disorders as a whole, but specifically like antisocial personality disorder would be probably like the most typical diagnosis for somebody who's going to be like really enjoy killing somebody in that kind of sadistic, awful way. But the research would say in general, that's probably going to be a mix of genetics and circumstances in their life. And so one way to think about that is actually for a lot of mental health issues is everybody is preloaded with their genetics. You get what you get. And that unique combination of genetics makes you more or less vulnerable to an environment that's either going to push you up towards crossing this clinical threshold of having a real problem, or the right environment will maybe lower the likelihood of that happening. So for the people, so in general, I don't work with people who are off the charts dangerous and scary like that. I am more likely to sexually see their family members. And so almost like 99 times out of 100, that when I did assessment, it was a story that these people have a childhood that's awful. It's not of their choosing. They didn't want to grow up in a home like that, but that's what they were given. And I think the research would, like I'm saying, the genetics sort of make that person predisposed to turn out like that, but then the environment just amps it right up and, you know, would create a Jeffrey Dahmer or somebody in war who would isn't acting as a soldier, but is acting as a murderer. And yeah, and that's really interesting. And you know, we talked a little bit about this before, but there are lots. It isn't just psychopaths that are doing mass murdering in like the Holocaust and World War II. I think the initial reaction to these concentration camps or learning the extent of the genocide is people thought, wow, how could all these psychopaths do this? Or, wow, Germany's filled with people who are filled with mass murderers. And they're not. They're actually, a lot of the people doing the killing before they were killing were normal everyday people without traumatic backgrounds. And the transition from not ever thinking of themselves as a murderer to then doing those horrendous acts is a really interesting question that isn't an abnormal psychology question. It's not what diagnosis do they have. It's a social psychology phenomenon. It's what are the contexts in the environment that would cause someone to do that? And I think that's a really interesting psychology question. And we have answers for that too.
So you're saying that the social pressure of the setting that they're in cause people to do some pretty dramatic things that they would never dream of doing on their own. But
yes.
Wow.
And it's not necessarily just the social pressure of the moment, but it's the greater context of what's happening. I didn't read the book, so I want to disclaimer there. This guy, I can't remember his name, but he gave a wonderful presentation. The book is called, I think, Ordinary Men. It's about the Holocaust, and it tracks the story of a killing squad for the Nazis. And what's really interesting about this one is the people who make up this particular unit of Nazis are men who are in their 40s. So at that point, they're too young to have served in World War I, so they don't have access. They wouldn't have known war in that way, and they're also too old to have been indoctrinated in a lot of like the Nazi propaganda that would have been going on in the 30s. They would have already been developed, so they're really low risk for buying into killing people is a good thing or Jews are bad, right? So they're in their 40s. They're also drafted. They didn't sign up to do this. So there's this whole unit of Germans that they're going into towns and they're rounding up the Jews and they're murdering them. This is going to turn into an awful conversation quickly, but here we are. And anyway,
which by the way, folks, it's going to get dark. So it's going to be a pretty talking about the mindset of what causes people to do awful things. But I think it's important to learn these lessons. So sorry.
No, I'm glad you said that. I totally agree, because what's really important is learning how this happens. So we don't do it. You know, if you're listening and you think, wow, I would never do that, you know, maybe you wouldn't, but like a lot of people around you would. And so we need to learn where we're vulnerable so we don't do that. So this is this really specific unit that you would think these are the last people who are going to commit genocide. And yet here they are doing it. And so this guy who did this research on this unit, I think did a really great job. I wish I could remember his name, but he sort of breaks the unit up into people fall into three different groups. So the first group, and was the smallest group, are the people that you're probably thinking of that you described, Eric, of like, these are like people who enjoy killing. These are like psychopaths. Like, yes, I'll go ahead and murder whoever you want me to. Let's go round up those people. Let's do that. The second group of people, the largest group, are people who will who will participate in the killings, but they are not eager about it. They are sick to their stomachs about it. They don't want to do it, but when interviewed, they talk about saying, I would rather do that than be seen as weak in front of everybody else. And that's kind of, you know, the social pressure you mentioned of like, I'm just going to do this, and I'm going to try to like mentally distance from this. I'm not going to enjoy it, but I'll do it. And then there's the third group of people, of these guys, and they would, you know, what I would describe as like a really passive, maybe even passive aggressive way, try to avoid killing anybody. And so they're saying, oh, you know, I'm really sick to my stomach. I can't do any killing, but I'll march all the Jews up to the backfield where you're going to slaughter them. I'll do that, but they won't ever want to pull the trigger. So it's like they found some mental gymnastics to create some distance from the atrocity, but still, you know, from the objective perspective, still very much participating in genocide. But for them, it's that. And from what I've read and understand, that those three groups are pretty common throughout all of the killing units in Germany, and the police battalions that did a lot of the killings. And as the war went on, there was less people in the middle group and more people on the extremes. People would start to gravitate towards the edges of either they would do it and they would do it a lot, or they wouldn't want to do it at all.
I'm looking up, because there's a thing, what you're talking about is that group of people, which I believe is the majority, that says, I could never do that. And that is the majority. Like you were saying, the minority are the psychopaths and the people who have a reason, which is what we as a society, I feel like, tend to go like, oh, I could never do that. I'm not a psychopath. I'm not a murderer.
Right.
But the majority fall into, I feel like, almost that middle category of like, and that's where in World War II, I know that's where like in the UCMJ, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, those rules started to come out like, hey, just because you were following orders, quote unquote, you will still be prosecuted for murder, and you have a moral obligation to say, no, I will not participate in that. And that's where that kind of developed, is because of those people who are just following orders.
Yeah. And that, you know, actually remind me, we'll circle back. There's actually a psychological experiment that was done based on that very thing you just said of, I was just following orders. They tried to figure out, what is that? What's that about? But that was like the number one defense in Nuremberg trials. I was just following orders. And so there wasn't a, what did I read? There wasn't a single defense attorney in the Nuremberg trials. So people that are defending these killers and the Nazis, that was able to present any documented evidence of somebody having significant consequences for not following orders. Now, it would have been common for superiors in the Nazi Party to say, you know, you got to kill these people or else. But when it came to or else, they didn't do anything. No one, at least there's any documentation of anybody being jailed or killed for not willing to participate in the killings. And in fact, nearing the end of the genocide, if somebody wanted to opt out of the killing, they could. They would let them do that. But they would have to, I think in writing, acknowledge that the killing was a good thing. I'm just too weak to continue it. So it's not like, oh, I'm morally opposed. That's not grounds to get out of it. You have to acknowledge that what they're doing is a good thing, and you're not, you know, you're not man enough to continue. You can't go against the party, I guess.
Sort of like forcing them to say, we are morally correct. You're just choosing not to duty.
Yep.
Man.
And it wasn't just the Hitler and the Nazi party. The messaging isn't just, we need to exterminate the Jews. It's we need to get rid of anybody that isn't, that can't participate, like able-bodied people. That like those are the only people with value. And so if you're disabled in some way, you don't have a role for in our society, and now we're justified in getting rid of you or killing you. And so that philosophy people bought into, but they quickly ran into a problem where German soldiers who are, you know, fighting for the Nazi party, they're coming back from the war wounded. They're not able-bodied anymore. And so I'm not an expert on this. I couldn't tell you how often this happened, but I from what I understand, it was not uncommon that a lot of the soldiers that are wounded are essentially being taken off into the woods and being killed, because we can't have wounded veterans walking around town not being able-bodied. That goes against the message of the Nazi Party. So they're killing their own soldiers for this too. I was never a soldier, but you were. I can't even imagine. It's one thing, I think, to be indoctrinated and to kill these people the Jews that we can even talk about the distance that they've had from the Jews that might make it easier for them to kill them, but to kill your own soldiers,
yeah,
or buddies.
I think it's one of those things, and I can even say, I would say during the global war on terror, it was kind of one of those things where I'm not saying it was genocide, not saying that at all, but I'm saying that there were some soldiers that actually went and actually slaughtered. There was actually a specific case. I want to say it was in 2013 or 14. Maybe it was 2000. No, probably like 2010. But there was a soldier that went off. He was a senior NCO, or not, he was an NCO, went off in the middle of the night and slaughtered an entire, I think like 30 people in a village and burned their bodies. Gosh. So like, yeah, I mean, it doesn't just happen in foreign militaries. Like, we've had our own cases within the US military where people have gone and done terrible things. But I think it even started with there'd be times like, derogatory terms like, the raghead or the, sand person, or saying classifying them other than like a human being.
Right.
And it's also very easy within the military to start to dehumanize, whether it's any military whatsoever, any type of conflict, it's very easy to dehumanize because it's a way, I think, for that soldier or that airman or whatever, that military member to make it easier on their conscience. So it's like, oh, I'm not killing a person, I'm just killing this thing, right? Mm-hmm. So like, it's kind of one of those things. And I think it's like a coping mechanism to kind of help. But it kind of follows in, I actually sent you the link to it in the chat, but it's the stages of genocide. So it starts off into different stages, and I'm pretty sure you're familiar with that step, or these stages, but I'll read them through for the audience. But it starts off with classification. So people are divided into them and us. Then it goes into symbolization, which, combined with hatred, symbols may be forced upon unwilling members. And then you have discrimination. So law or cultural power excludes group from full rights, segregation, apartheid laws, denial of voting. And then you go into dehumanization. So one group denies humanity of the other group. Hey, those vermin, those rats, classifying them as some sort of animal almost, right? So dehumanizing the other side. And then organization. So this is where it becomes where the government now becomes involved in helping with the eradication. So a special military or a special unit or a police force that is tasked with organizing the opponent and then isolating them, right? So like, okay, we're not going to kill them, but we're just going to put them somewhere else, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you have polarization. So extremists driving the groups apart, and then the leaders of that group are either arrested or taken out. And then you have preparation. So what do we do with all these people? All right, we can't just have them there. So now we have to develop a plan to get rid of them, send them somewhere else, ship them off, or mass killing. And then you have persecution. So they're now putting them in a camp or putting them in a gas chamber. And that, after persecution, because of logistics and stuff like that, it leads to extermination, which is then killing them because it is their right. And then it goes into denial, meaning justification for their actions.
And that reads exactly, I mean, there's a couple of steps that might be in a different order, but like exactly of the rise of the Nazi party, of Hitler, of, I think, like, at least in my head, before I had learned a lot about this, in my head, it was the war starts. And then all of a sudden, everybody's on board with rounding up disabled people, people of color, and Jews, and exterminating them. And that's not at all how it happened, at least in the Holocaust. I think there's other genocide that happens a lot more rapidly than that. But this was, I think, Hitler gains essentially autonomous power in 1933. And one of the first laws he does is he says Jews can't be in government. Jews can't have professional positions. They can't be doctors anymore. It strips them of any like license to practice. 2 years later, passes a law that says, so this is part of like the classification of them versus us, and then stripping them of power. And then in 1935, he says, makes it illegal for any, that I think it's any German citizen, you can't have sexual relationships with any Jewish people. And so to even not be accused of that, because that would be a crime, people stop socializing with the Jews. So you've got now, this is, that is a huge turning point. And now there's this social distancing between German citizens and the Jewish population, or the Jewish Germans at the time, although they might have been stripped of their rights of citizens at that point. And so when the genocide starts in 1941, you've got Germans that haven't probably even seen a Jewish person for 6 years. And they've only, in over those 6 years, only heard stories about, like where you're starting with is of dehumanizing them, calling them vermin. And so, and then if you're, the first time you're seeing them is in a concentration camp, it's so awful they don't even look like people anymore. And so the again, the mental gymnastics that someone would have to do, I think, to commit some of those acts, it's not that big of a gap at that point. And that should scare everybody. Now, I think Germany's different. There's a lot of, democracy wasn't even a thing in Germany until the 19-teens. I don't know the year. But, you know, we have 200 years of democracy where everybody matters and everyone gets a vote. They had 10. And so they're not used to, they're used to someone like Hitler saying, hey, this is what everyone should believe.
Yeah, I mean, that's terrifying. I think, you know, it's funny as I think about like here in the States, like how we are already, I feel like here in the States, the general populace is not necessarily involved in this polarization, but because of media and, you know, leaders in power, there is such a strong polarization where we're starting to head. I feel like we're at almost sometimes number six, where it's like on both sides of the political spectrum, the agenda and the media is pushing these things, which yeah. I don't feel like the general population, the majority are not feeling that way, but we're being told to feel that way. And you know, it's something that's scary is like, obviously Russia and the Ukraine thing, there's a lot of stuff going on. And even with like China, but that also is another way that I feel like just on both sides, whether it's China, Russia doing it to the West or the West doing it over there, very easy to be able to say, oh, they're the bad guys. And that's where you start to see like these titles being placed, you know, like in the, mm-hmm. in World War II, it's like, oh, well the Japs, you know, or yeah. You know, in World War I, they call them the Jerrys, you know, or whatever. They provided these names that were villainizing the other side to where they now become no longer human. You're a vermin yeah. that need to be exterminated. And evil, according to that, you know, their own side is saying, well, the Americans are evil. You know, the Japanese told an entire village. I mean, when they were going through the Solomon Islands and these different islands, there's an entire village that committed suicide when these villagers, when the Marines were coming close to their area, because I think it was Okinawa, and they were like, they were been told they're going to rape and murder and kill your
gosh.
They were like, I would rather die. And so there's actually really famous videos, real old footage of the Marines videotaping these villagers jumping off the cliffs and committing suicide because they were taught this is what the other side thinks of us.
Yeah.
And we, and likewise were, you know, also, I think through experiences because of some of their tactics and techniques of like committing suicide or, you know, utilizing suicide to take out as many Marines as they could, we now started to dehumanize them. Like what human could possibly do that when it was just a cultural difference? But, you know, in Japan, it was you would die for honor. It was honorable to die in battle. But for us, it's like, if I have a chance to surrender and live, why would I not do that? Going back to here in the States, it's very easy to see, you know, people go, oh, that could never happen here. But it's one of those things is like, well, let's take a step back and look at what did Nazi Germany look like prior to Hitler going into power. It looked very similar to the steps that we are starting to take if we don't stop and take a step back and say, no. It doesn't matter, like, we need to be able to come back to the table and have conversations again, you know? But now it's like, oh, I can't even associate with you if you have certain ideas or ideals. And that's that starts to become a really scary thought.
I think that that's when you said that it's really easy to dehumanize them, not just through like coming up with I can't think of the name, but it, like prejudicial names. But it's just a cultural difference that you can have a mindset of like, wow, I'm going to visit this other country. I'm going to learn all about this culture and it'll be cool. And I'll, you know, I'll try, I don't know. I'll try real Thai food for the first time, right? Like that's a cultural experience. Or you're an invading country or, you know, you have this cultural difference and it's seen as a way of dehumanizing them, of, you know, of Japanese, all, you know, make up a stereotype of all they ever eat is rice. And so they don't eat beef. So that makes them lesser than in some way. And as a soldier, it's easy to just like, if you're in a country where you're not from, they're going to do things a lot differently than you. And it's just really easy to judge that and say that your way is better. And to circle back to what you're saying of within this country, there's a massive, like, there's massive intersections of cultural clashes that seem to be happening all the time that we're really struggling to reconcile, where one cult, like whatever position you have, I think you're right, it's becoming it's becoming a position where you have to dig your heels in and try to claim your space rather than try to understand the other person's position. And I think, I don't know if this is like controversial or not, but I'm going to say something like maybe somewhat provocative, I guess. But I think if you're walking around and thinking, man, this country is really going into the shitter because of people who vote blue or because people who vote red, and that's the problem, I think you're the problem. If you think it's a political party that's going to... That either political party is responsible for these problems, it's you in thinking that it's a political party and that yours needs to win. Because if you feel like the country needs to be run by the red or the blue, then you're committing intellectual genocide on half the country. I should really say that because genocide is a really awful thing and we shouldn't compare it to intellect. But you're like circumcising an entire half of the country's thinking, and we grow through diverse ideas, not by shutting people out. It's further away from democracy when we do stuff like that.
You know what's funny is it's like both sides, you have a far right and you have a far left, and the issue with having one extreme side that's in power, whether left or right, there's always going to be a rebound from that. And sometimes the rebound is never recoverable. I think the one episode, I watched the Sean Ryan episode, and he was interviewing a girl I've actually listened to several times on different podcast platforms. And she was, I can't remember her name, but she was a refugee. She escaped from North Korea. And what was extremely alarming was obviously her experiences and her journey of escaping is horrific. If you haven't listened to it, I highly recommend it. I'm actually going to look up the link and see her name. But what was absolutely terrifying is at the end is she talked about the similarities in the direction that we as a country are going that she saw in North Korea. So these things of only one ideology, only one idea, how the state or the media was pushing a narrative to drive the population to believe, whether it was true or not, to believe a certain way, or that things were going a certain way, that these problems needed to be fixed and here is the solution, which was not being thought of by the general population or even the opinion of the general population, but being driven by the media and that narrative to help drive what they want. And what she was talking about and the similarities that she is seeing here in the States and the type of agendas that are being pushed that she sees and then started to experience is absolutely terrifying. I was like, holy smokes. Like,
oh boy.
She had actually talked about how you know, she had escaped from North Korea and she was living in Chicago at the time, which is like a couple years ago when everything went down. And just because, even though she was Asian, just because she had white skin, she was now an oppressor. She was a this, that, and the other thing. And she's like, I escaped from oppression and know what that's like. I can't believe I'm being labeled as that. And now I need to be eradicated. And it's crazy. She's like, America is the one place in the world where people try to escape to. So if America goes away, there's nowhere to go. There's nowhere to escape from the horrors of some of these tyrannical countries. There's nowhere for people to go. This is the last stop. And so preserving that through conversation, through ideas, through seeing how do we stop this division by sitting to the table and having conversations is the only way to preserve the last lifeboat we have left on Earth.
That's, yeah, I never thought about, I guess I'm pretty me-centered, that I think about like needing to preserve what's good about the United States for us, the people who live here, and not really thinking of the ripple effect for the rest of the world, or even just feeling like, you know, we kind of have, whether we ask for it or not, there might be a social obligation to have a space on the planet for the people who don't have anywhere else to go, to be able to have a place. And if that's gone, how does that change the rest of the world? I don't know if another country would step up or not, but
I mean, I don't think that there would be. I mean, and her name is Yeonmi Park. What's insane is, excuse me, the horrors that she faced as a child. Her mother, just a real quick snippet about her. Her mother was so desperate because people were starving to death. And she also kind of explained like the stages of starving to death and how absolutely terrible it is. But it was so bad that her mother didn't want her child to suffer that fate and escaped with her. It was a better option to sell her child as a sex slave in China through human trafficking than to have her live life in North Korea. And that is the epitome of like how absolutely low life, the standard of living is there, where everybody believes a singular thought in North Korea. Everybody believes in one thing.
Yeah.
There's only one person on the ballot. You know, like that's what happens when you have one side driving everything. And then it starts to go down a real dark path. And that's what makes America great, is the fact that we have so many different opinions. We have so many different cultures. We have so many good ideas to bring to the table. But when we start going down a path of, okay, polarizing ourselves and, oh, only this group of people should have be running things and have these ideas, that's when you start to go into a real dark place. And I think a real good case of that, that honestly isn't talked about much, which if you haven't watched the movie The Killing Fields, it's a super depressing movie, but it's about the killing fields in Cambodia that happened after Vietnam, when the communists came in, and it is just absolutely terrible. But we are fools to think that it could not happen here, and that's the fastest way for history to repeat itself.
That maybe all of us, me, I don't know, but maybe people listening, if you think whatever problem it is, pick any controversial topic of abortion or gun control or whatever it is. If you think there's only one way to solve the problem, you're probably in a vulnerable position. You need to be thinking of there are probably multiple ways to solve a problem, and maybe there is one that is better than the others. But to say my way is the only way and your way is awful is really not a charitable engagement in problem solving. And I think that's where people get stuck. And just as a side note, this is a little bit, it's related, but I have to vent. I'm so tired of being on social media and seeing an example of something happening that fits a stereotype or a political narrative, and it gets passed around as if this is the state of things. So pick whatever you want. Pick a concealed carry permit holder who shoots himself in the groin or kills somebody by accident. And that gets passed around as if that's the state of this country, as if that's how things are. Or the other side of pick a trans person at a drag show of a video of talking to a child and thinking like, see, look what all the trans people are doing to our children. Or, and as if like one person, just FYI on statistics, one example of something doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean anything. There are so many steps that we need to take to draw firm conclusions about things. And an anecdote, a singular personal story, whether it's yours or one that you see online or on Twitter, that doesn't mean anything. And I think we need to remember that, because it's just so easy to see the one example and it feed our own confirmation bias of, well, that's, see, I am entitled to believe what I believe because I just saw this story of this one person acting in the way that I don't like.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think if you go back to the singular thought of reminding yourself that it's a psyop and at the end of the day, at the end of the day, we live in an information war and the prize is your mind. And,
well said.
That is something where I think like we are being marketed to, influenced. I mean, they literally call social media your feed. They are feeding your mind with whatever it is they're trying to sway and gain your support. Everything is a psyop. Like, I don't believe anything that I see unless I have hard evidence and a lot of facts to back it up that remain consistent. It would say, like, even in the CIA, those guys, there's actually a Sean Ryan episode, and I keep referencing him because he's put in a lot of great content recently. But he interviews a CIA guy, and he was saying, in that intelligence agency, they say, hey, this is with high probability. They don't say it's a certainty. They say it's high probability, and here are the facts to support that claim. Or it's, this is probable, but, or high certainty that this is the case. But, or if it's high probability or it's probable, it's like, yes, we believe this, but we don't have the evidence yet to back that up to say it is a certainty. So,
yeah,
you have to start thinking. And I think the biggest thing is a lot of the issues that we have today in society is our society is running off of headlines. Like, we read off of a meme or a headline on a meme or on social media, and we go, this is the facts. When it turns out, like, no, you have to be a free thinker and go, let me do a little bit of digging, just a tiny bit of research, and you're already light years ahead of the rest of the population. The key is how do we as a population start to go through kind ways of influencing our friends and family, saying, hey, do some research, like, dig a little bit deeper. Cool. Find your facts, gain a little bit of intel, and then make your opinion.
Or maybe even do all that and come to a tentative conclusion. That so can I want to go a slight tangent, but it's related. It's actually a study you reminded me of it has to do with free will a little bit, and I think this is probably the most interesting study I've read in 20 years, and I don't think enough people know about it. Maybe you've heard of it, maybe you haven't. But I think the results are incredibly fascinating and the implications are interesting, and nobody seems to be talking about it. So is that okay? Can I talk about it, Eric?
Go ahead, send it.
So we're gonna send it. Okay. So I can't remember what year this was, maybe 2016. They hooked subjects up to an fMRI. So maybe if you've had an fMRI, it takes like if you have your knee done, it'll take a picture of your knee. fMRI is a functioning fMRI, so it actually shows what's happening in real time. So people will they'll have an injection, what's called a contrast, like iodine or something, and it will show the blood flow on the fMRI machine on a screen in real time and in your brain. And so they can watch what parts of the brain are getting more blood flow, and that correlates with more increased activity in the brain. And so we can say, well, when we have this person do this task, we can say they're using this part of the brain more than the other parts. And that's good data. So they hooked people up to an fMRI machine, and they basically said, I'm going to simplify it a little bit. They said, there's two buttons in front of you. You can pick either, you can press either button. Doesn't matter which one. But we just want you to pick one, make the decision, and then press it. And so the people, they look at the buttons, they make the decision, they press it. And they, the people, the researchers looking at this person's brain can predict which button they're going to press before they make the decision by 7 seconds. That's a long time.
Wow.
So right away, the implication is like, what? That doesn't make any sense. And at least on the surface, it appears for maybe a simple task like that, there's a part of your brain that has decided which button you're going to press. Like the organic part of your brain has figured that out before it actually enters the state of your consciousness to have a decision. It's already been decided, which really, I think, terrifies me and is also really cool. And it does sort of bring up the nature of like free will and how do we make decisions. It doesn't suggest like you're not in charge of like who you marry or where you live. Those are really complicated decisions. But pressing a button, I don't know. And so part two, so some of the criticisms of the study, they wanted to do a part two because there was a criticism that said, well, you know, sometimes we have like muscle memory. And so if you didn't expect it and I threw a baseball at you, Eric, you might just reach out and catch it with your hand without even really having a conscious decision to do it. So pressing a button is a physical activity and maybe we're tapping into the muscle memory and it's not actually a choice. So they did the study again, but they changed it. And they said, okay, we're going to show you two numbers, like 7 and 4, and your job is to either choose to add them or subtract them. So you could either say 11 or you could say 3. And make the decision and then tell us what the number is. Same thing. They could predict whether the person was going to add or subtract 4 seconds before the person said that they had actually decided. That's crazy. So it's not complicated math, but you're definitely using your brain power to make a choice of what am I going to do, add or subtract. And it's decided before you think it is.
So is it like a study on like predestination somewhat, or?
I think it's a study, like the limits of it would I think essentially be, it really would just be limited to choice. And if we should be, it's actually, the study is only actually the generalizability of the study is really just limited to these two tasks. You can't say it applies to anything else until you test it. So it applies to doing addition and subtraction in a simple way and pressing one of two buttons. I don't know. I mean, I guess people could take a spiritual or religious perspective and have an opinion about that. But I think it just really invites some interesting questions about you think you're in charge of the choices you make probably a little bit more than you actually are.
Mm. So kind of, human nature, I guess, kind of comes into that. I wonder if that's something that is trying to say like, hey, we do have a predictable pattern as human beings. I think it kind of, I don't even know what to think about that.
It's hard. It kind of breaks the brain a little bit. Like, I think maybe, I have a reaction of like, I don't want that to be true. I don't want that to be true.
Maybe they already knew that I would be wrapped around that. Oh gosh. Yeah. I mean, was that the majority that had that, or is it almost every applicant that had that they could predict that?
From what I remember, I can't remember the total specifics. Whether it's like it's statistically significant, like this is doing it way better than chance, or if it's everybody, which I could also see it being everybody. You know, there isn't a person where they can't tell. It's short of like having a brain injury or TBI or something. But what I actually hear in your question though is, I don't want that to be true for me, or I don't want that to be true for as much as it might be.
Yeah, I think honestly, well, I mean, it kind of makes sense because it's like if you look at, let's just say, for example, we call it in the military, we call it pattern of life, right? So humans are predictable in everything that they do. They have a pattern of life. Mm-hmm. And one of the things, you know, for like, say, for example, if you're going undercover or doing some sort of thing like that, it's trying to be unpredictable. And that honestly takes conscious thought to do something different than what you'd normally want to do, because your body would want to go, I want to find a predictable pattern because it's easier, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, for us, like in the military, like for example, like if I was, you know, had a feed, like a predator feed up, and I was watching, you know, a target and saying, okay, I know that he's going to go here. This is what he does every day. He stops by here to get lunch. He drives his motorcycle from point A to point B. All right. The best time to hit him with a missile or something like that is during that, you know, time where he is driving from destination A to destination B. There's not a lot of people there. He goes at this certain time of day. We can predict a traffic pattern, but yeah, it's very predictable. Yeah. So you establish a pattern of life. And sometimes through that pattern of life, you can also, you know, convict somebody of them doing something nefarious by saying, hey, why is he going out at 11 o'clock every night and then not coming back till 4 in the morning? Okay, now that's something, it's a cue to, now we need to investigate that, observe him, do some recon and watch him for a while or whatever. But I think it's unnatural to disrupt that pattern of life. Is mm-hmm. It's unnatural to break your routine because it's harder to do. You have to go outside the norm. So that kind of makes sense. It kind of supports the fact that we are very predictable and that we want to follow a pattern.
Like, I think it would be, and I would imagine they accounted for this, but to your point, it would be interesting to say, you know, if we throw in another variable we're not accounting for, like, do right-handed people pick the button on the right side? And is it actually picking up on that in some way? It's actually picking up on the anticipation of using the right side of your body. I mean, I would imagine they've accounted for that. But I think the study was repeated where they have to do it enough times where there isn't any human behavior pattern of, are you picking left or right over and over and over again? And the machine is saying, when you try to do something random, it's predicting your random pattern before you even try to do it. Which, again, I don't like that.
Well, I think honestly, I think I kind of believe in that claim that it's easy. I think the experiment is already predicting what someone who is untrained is already going to do based off of their pattern, right? Which is a common pattern throughout humans. Mm. And I think that it requires extra training. So someone who did something unpredictable have obviously been trained in being unpredictable, whether through a program or training themselves, but training themselves to break away from that pattern, and that would be an anomaly.
That maybe the brain isn't picking up and making the choice for you. It's picking up on the history of what you always do. And,
correct, yeah.
And I think, and I don't know the extent of the study to this degree, but if you run it enough times, the person's going to be faced with this new life script, I'm putting in quotes, I don't know, where they wouldn't have any history to pull from. So you say, pick her left or right and do it 100 times and do random every time. There isn't a history where you're going to pull from something because it's going to be a totally new experience. But I think another interesting psychology study, here we go, where it is also predictive of people's behavior, to your point, is have you ever heard of the marshmallow test?
No, but go ahead, entertain me. Do I get a marshmallow at the end of this story?
There are no marshmallows available because you're too old to participate, unfortunately. they took a group of, oh boy, I'm going to say 500 or 600 kids, huge, huge sample for this kind of thing. And they were all between 4 and 6 years old. And they took individually, one at a time, they took the kid and they put him in a room by themselves. And a researcher would go in and he would say, here is a marshmallow. You can have this marshmallow right now and you can eat it. And then you can play with some toys and do whatever you want. It's fine. Or I'm going to put this marshmallow here. And if you don't eat it, I'm going to come back in 15 minutes. And then I'm going to give you a second marshmallow for waiting. And then you can have both. And then you can go play with some toys. And it's funny because some of the studies on video, it's funny to watch the kids wrestle. Like they'll cover their mouths or cover their face, or they'll put the hand over the marshmallow to try not to eat it. the results were about one third of the kids were able to hold off and wait to get the second marshmallow. Two thirds ate it. Now, that's probably not that interesting of a study, but what makes this one particularly cool is they followed those kids all the way into adulthood. And so they, every few years, they would check in with them and give them surveys and check in on their life. And what they found was the kids that were able to maintain the kind of self-control, even at 4 and 6 years old, it predicted higher SAT scores, higher overall education, lower BMI, and higher overall life satisfaction, like well into adulthood.
What is BMI?
Body mass index. So the larger the number, your ratio from height to weight, suggesting you're overweight, the higher the number.
Right, right.
What's also cool about this study is it's not necessarily like, wow, so those one third of the kids that are like born that way or have the genetics to be able to resist the marshmallow, like that's the ticket to a happy life. This stuff can be learned and trained. Like you can work with your kid or even practice as an adult of working on saying no to those kinds of temptations, and it sets them up for life better. That we're using a marshmallow to measure discipline, essentially. And even at 4 or 6, it's really predictive of what their life is going to look like.
I mean, it kind of makes sense, like, scripturally, in scripture, it says, hey, you know, you can see a person's heart by their fruits, meaning you can see what type of person they are based off of their actions and the fruits of their life. If I was to think about, this kind of leads me to kind of, you know, we were talking about before in person about prepping and being prepared and prepared citizen. The types of persons that prepare, and there's three types of people I've heard conversations about. The type of person who prepares for them and themselves and screw everybody else. I got enough for me and my family, right? The type of person who says, I'm not going to prepare. I'm just going to, when that time comes, I'm going to kill you and take everything you have.
Oh, boy.
And then you have the other person who's like, hey, I'm going to prepare. But at the same time, I'm thinking about the opportunity that I will have to be able to be in a position to help as many people as I possibly can. Mm-hmm. So that kind of, you know, it's interesting that those – would you say that there are some people who have strong discipline and utilize their disciplines to, yes, they may be hardworking, but are not interested in helping other people per se, you know, like they're disciplined and they're kind of in that one track mind. So I guess we're kind of breaking off into another type of personality, but,
I think there's this concept of somebody put it once, the community of social obligation, that as a human being, it's really healthy for all of us to have an innate sense of obligation, not just, this isn't like charity, I'm going above and beyond, but it is an obligation to look out for each other. And in my world, the degree to like that's on a spectrum where that can get thrown off on the extremes of either end, where you've got the person who doesn't prepare. And yeah, I've heard people, and it really scares me, where they say, oh yeah, if the world went to hell, I'm going to go, like just what you said, I'm going to start kicking in neighbors' doors and I'm going to take what they have. And if they're there, then I'm going to put them down right there. And I'm just like, what is wrong with you? Right? Like you're on the extreme end of no social obligation, but there's also the other extreme of too much. These people, you know, they're in the helping profession and they'll bury, they'll work themselves to death helping other people, never putting themselves first in a really unhealthy way. I would probably rather like hang out with those people in the extreme if I had to choose, but yeah, some people can go really sideways. And honestly, you know, in my experience, the people with such low empathy towards that, I mean, they've had life experiences where the world was awful to them. You know, their parents were awful, or they were abused, or like they were really bullied in a terrible way. That they learned that from somewhere. They learned people that,
right.
I got treated like I don't matter, so I learned people don't matter.
Yeah. So I mean, that's something that's like, I know, I think in the impacts, like I'm a parent, so like the impacts that I have as a parent, which to me is the most important job you can possibly have, is being able to impress upon my kids how to be whenever they grow up, because they are going to impact society. They're going to impact other people's lives.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's one thing that I feel like we have in this modern age lost the ability to connect with our kids. We let other distractions and things get in the way, where now we're not teaching them those morals and what that means to have empathy, to be giving. Right now, it's always, I feel like, especially in our society today, it's so much about, it's all about me, you know? Whereas before, I feel like it was, you know, how many people will say hello to you when you go out to the store? Not very many. Whereas like when I listen to my grandfather and seeing them interact with people whenever as a kid, it was always, hey, how you doing? And hello, mm-hmm. and all that stuff. Passing a greeting, passing some sort of kind gesture. But I feel like we're starting to lose that, and that in turn, not being impressed upon our kids, is going to keep that snowball rolling downhill, where eventually it's just going to be, we're a bunch of people. We could be alone in the middle of a crowd and truly be alone.
And that's it. And, you know, I feel that in today's age of growing up, maybe like you, where I would say hi to more people. And now the only way I can describe it as a personal experience for me is it's tiring. It's too tiring to go out of your way to be friendly to people. And I don't know why that is. And maybe that's just my experience and people can't relate to that. But there's just something that's more exhausting about being friendly to people I don't know than it used to be. I don't know. Maybe I'm out of practice. Maybe it's like working out and I need to practice.
Yeah. I mean, I think about like, well, you know, when we get together as a group with our group that we go and we train together and stuff like that, I think that's something that is and that goes back to kind of our original staple of we've lost the ability to have a community of so many people through shared interests and passions and being good people and good human beings. We've lost that sense that now it's a phenomenon. When before, who knows, it probably could have been like, oh, that's just normal. But now it's a phenomenon that there is a community of people that get together who are friends that strive to be better, but also are willing to make sacrifices to help somebody else. So
yeah,
to me, sometimes it's sad. It's sad that that's a phenomenon. I wish it was just more normal. And I hope it does become more normal. Because at the end of the day, training and preparedness and all this stuff is just an outlet to find like-minded people to build community. It's just a tool. But maybe it does start with, you know, it starts with the individual. It starts with the person saying, let me go connect with that person. You know, kind of like when there's new guys that come in, the amount of guys that go out and be like, hey man, what's your name? You know, when'd you start? Hey, what are you working on? Here, come with me. Mm-hmm. That's not normal. Not normal today. And so that's why because it's not normal, it's inspiring to see that. And I hope that continues to grow.
I think what's also cool is, at least within our group, that people have a variety of different reasons for what they want to get out of training. And there isn't, I haven't experienced a lot of judgment. If I met a new person and they said, yeah, I want to train because, you know, I want to enlist in the army, I'd say, awesome. I think you picked a great spot. If somebody else said, I'm here because I like shooting, and but primarily I'm out of shape and I want to get in shape. I'd say, great, this is the right spot. There isn't, I don't think a lot of people have a judgment about, there has to be some righteous reason, or like my reason has to agree with yours, and you know, to get back to like having the open-mindedness of what someone wants to get out or why they're going to that community. If you want it to be a healthy one, probably not everybody's idea for going is going to be the same, and you need to be open to that.
Yeah. I mean, to your point, within our group, there are people that go there for competition. There are people that go there to get back into shape. There are people that go there for self-defense and preparedness of their family.
Yep.
There are people that go there just to, because they just enjoy it. So like,
yeah, I think they go there for just to talk.
I think a lot of people go, I think in my honest opinion, just to talk and hang out.
Yep.
And it just happens to be the thing that they get to do together with other people.
Yep.
And I think that within the human genome, there's always been a striving for community.
Yeah.
And it's always been in our DNA to group together. And I think that through social media, and this is where I think, you know, obviously it's an outlet for Barrel and Hatchet and we have to use social media, but sometimes I hate it because it's teaching and training people to have that community outlet without being there in person. Mm. And in that way we become isolated. And I think there is a deep need for us as human beings to physically have community. I think it's important. I think it's another reason why there are maybe, would you say, is there a growing mental health crisis here in modern society than there was before?
I don't know. I don't know that the data, I don't know that anyone's, let me back up. Usually the presenting problem historically in a lot of mental health settings, the number one thing used to be depression. It flipped to anxiety, I want to say, in the late 90s. I haven't read anything about the impact of COVID in particular, where I would, you know, where I could confidently say like this is a direct impact. We do know mental health numbers are way up. That's certainly. I don't know what the presenting problem is. I think anecdotally for me. So again, huge qualifier. What I'm about to say doesn't mean anything. Only it's just my experience, which is loneliness is up. The lack of, when I say, you know, with every person I meet, I'm going to ask them, like, what does your social support system look like? Like, who do you hang out with? Tell me about the people who, like, you love having in your life. Tell me about the people you don't. More and more, the shift in the last 4 years is people used to tell me, oh, like my best friends are, we hang out every Saturday night. We go do this thing. Now it's my best friend is in Tennessee. My best friend is in California. That it is like a lot of the people's primarily social connections with other people. It's the people they live with. And then it's going to be people online. And, I don't think that's a good thing. I don't have an answer for it, but
I mean, it seems like people are, instead of trying to establish new relationships and connections, they're holding on to the old ones and not going out and venturing to make new ones that are in person.
Yeah.
You know, and I think a lot of it, to me, in my personal opinion, and this is my opinion, I think that technology has caused that. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, how it's rare, you know, it'd be like, yeah, I met this girl, you know, out at the movies, or we met at a restaurant or whatever. And it's like, no, we met on Tinder.
Yeah.
And it's just like a swiping app, you know, so it's like,
yeah,
we've lost our ability to connect, to engage with people. And I think we've lost that sense of community. I mean, I think from a veteran's aspect, there is, I think it was like 22 suicides a day. Is now up to 23. So they call it Mission 22. Now it's Mission 23. The veteran suicide rate is skyrocketing. And I think it boils down to a lack of community And because of that lack of community, meaning they were in a community, they had a purpose, they had brothers and sisters in arms that they could be around. It was a family. They left that. And because they have lost that community, they fail to find purpose. And that purpose and lack of purpose and loneliness is causing depression to a point where it's irreversible mistakes that are made. So I think that's the one thing, like, you know, no matter what type of, you know, industry or, you know, the training industry, how I think that's something that, like, I always wanted to push is working together versus, you know, working against my competition has never been more important, because the last thing that this community needs, and any community in general, despite what industry it's in, the last thing it needs is negativity. And what negativity does is it destroys that. You know, it was one of those things where, like, if there's bickering within a group, it is, and someone's like, oh, well, you know, this group, this, that, or whatever, I kind of want to go and I say, look, well, you can identify the bickering or you can identify the problems, but what are you doing to fix it? Especially if it's within a group of people that you care about and you start to notice it, that is the time to nip it in the bud, because you end up having those factions, forms, or cliques, which I freaking hate cliques, but you start to have those things form and then they isolate and then the community starts to break up and break apart. And right now, no matter what it is, I mean, it could be the community of basket weaving. There is no, we don't have the time to go backwards and go into a group or a community and start to develop negativity. In fact, it's one of those things that I'm always telling folks, I'm like, you need to, if you see something negative, then you need to be the person that takes charge and says, hey, let's help mediate these problems. And it usually starts off with simple, stupid things. Let's help mediate these problems versus, you know, whispering behind backs and gossip, and all of a sudden you have things form and then you have fracture. From small, tiny groups like ours or whatever community that people are in to globally or nationally, you know, we tend to take for granted things that we have, especially the community. And before you know it, the community dies away and then you're like, what happened? You know, like, where did that go? How did it even start? How did that even start where it fractured? More importantly, especially on social media, like, if there's something negative, you just got to step away from it, because one, your life is going to be a lot better. It's not going to be as, you won't have that toxicity in there. But if you're always the one trying to be the person with a clear mind to help moderate things, to see both sides, man, things could be a lot better.
That I think there's, it is natural to probably, it's certainly natural to get along with certain kinds of people or certain personalities more than others. And it's maybe even unconsciously to gravitate towards somebody who maybe you, or a group of people you resonate with a little bit more, to create a subgroup within a bigger group. But if you're going to call it a clique, that, to my, in my mind, that word has more implications, which means it's not just a subgroup within a group, but it's exclusionary in some way. And in my experience, or at least in psychology, I think that normal phenomenon of people getting along with others within a group gets misinterpreted when people have a more fragile sense of self. That Eric, you can like somebody better than me at JTAC, and that doesn't threaten our relationship or me as a person. I don't feel like I have less value if you don't like me as much as somebody else. But if I am sensitive to that, then I start to have a problem with your friends and you. And I might even start to feel like I'm being excluded when you've done nothing to do that. Or if you're in the group and you feel your sense of worth is a little more fragile, and you find value and worth in exclusion, in being the exclusive group, and you're excluding me, then that's another way for that tension to form going the other direction. And I am going to feel excluded for reasons that are true. And it's so, you know, to your point, I think that toxicity you're describing, I think it often forms from people looking for self-worth and esteem in the wrong places. Like, you matter as a person just because you exist. Like, there are not a lot of humans out there in the entire universe that we know of. Like, the fact that you exist right now makes you, I think, the most valuable item in the universe that I know of. Like, another human being is an incredibly special, unique thing. And to feel like you need other people's total or universal acceptance, or you need to reject somebody else to feel like that adds to your specialness as a person, is really feeding from a place that I think makes groups vulnerable to the kind of drama that you're talking about.
I think it is for those types of people in the community or in a community in general that have the ability to see that the fragileness of somebody else's self-worth, or the, you know, the ability of somebody else in the group to be able to, you know, be friendly to everybody. It is, would you say it is a responsibility of someone to be a leader in that way to say, hey, not being a part of a certain designated group within the group, but saying, hey, providing outlets and ways to make sure that even though there are people that, you know, are more friendly to each other because they just identify, you know, they find more in common things versus somebody else, being a moderator as a leader to say, hey, we can all still find our differences and make the corrections, or at least guide and mentor people towards, even though, yes, there's subgroups, but making sure that there's no negativity between those subgroups within the larger group.
I think, yes, I think a good leader is aware of their own natural desires that are natural desires that they get out of the group. And they're also aware of the needs of the group as a whole, and they can hold those needs concurrently. And so if I had, well, let's just say if you had three people in a group in let's just say JTAC that you were like, those are your three best friends, it would be really easy for you to get caught up in only talking to those three people and accidentally send out a vibe of like, I only want to hang out with these three people. And that wouldn't be true, but you're just doing what feels good. I think good leaders have the awareness that they don't get caught up in that, because if you have a responsibility to the entire group, then you can't just be talking to three people. And looking for those people who struggle with social skills, they're not as socially adept, and modeling what good social skills look like for that other person to find a way to fit in. I think that's absolutely a group leader's responsibility. And I don't know what you think. Actually, what do you think about more than one leader of a group with the same status? The same power, I should say.
Well, I mean, I think that it depends. I think there's different types of leadership styles. You know, for me, I actually, funny, there's this thing in the Air Force. When I went through NCO school, they had us do these four lenses, and it was like four different colors or whatever. And you did a survey, and you would rank based off from highest to lowest. Like, you would get, I'm this percentage purple, I'm this percentage orange, I'm this percentage red, or whatever it is.
A lot of hot pink for you.
I think purple was like the super emotional one.
That's about right.
And in the group, I was sitting at the table because they put all the colors together. You know, like, hey, all the light colors that had the highest percentage of these colors, you'd sit in the table. And I sat at the table with all the girls. And the funny thing is, it's that I see there's a lot of, you know, there's leaders who are task driven and it is the mission before all other things. And kind of put, hey, what you're feeling, that doesn't really matter right now. What matters is the task at hand. Mm-hmm. There are leaders also who emotionally are involved, but also let the emotions drive them in their leadership style, which honestly becomes more unpredictable, mm-hmm. right? And also can cause a lot of division. And then there are those who are analytical, like they break down everything to a science, and based off of the statistics and the odds, this is what we're supposed to do because that's what the data shows. I think no matter what, you're going to trend in a stronger area than others, but the most abnormal is the one that's pretty even across the board. I think, though, that for somebody who is extremely special is the person that is either high in one category, but can identify the other categories as areas to work on to help them become more rounded as a leader. I think if there were two different heads, I think it depends on the individual who is more rounded, well-rounded, or has taught themselves to become more well-rounded to either encourage or mentor another leader that is stronger in only one suit, but also at the same time not cause division or a friction point with that other person by going against their leadership style, but working with that leadership style to enhance their strong suit, but at the same time make up the difference for the things that they lack in. And so, you know, I feel like, and this is why I think that those who are in touch with the emotional side of things and are having an ability to connect with the human element tend to be able to be better and more adept to identify areas that they need to train on more because they know overall the health of the group is going to require a leader that's well-rounded, and that emotionally is going to be a positive thing. So I think, I think the biggest thing is for me, I've learned to, as a leader in aspects of life, to perfect being a follower, but at the same time, not be only a follower. I think that as a leader, you have to know when it's time to follow. And it's also when it's time to take up the mantle and say, okay, this is what we're doing. And this is the direction the ship is heading. If for those who are in a leadership position that do not know how to follow, I don't think that leadership is going to be very easy for them in the long run. That's why, in my opinion,
interesting,
some of the best leaders in the military were, in my personal opinion, those who were prior enlisted before they became an officer, because they were put in a position where they had to be told, you're at the bottom of the totem pole, you're told to do everything, and you had to follow, but then took the mantle of a leadership position as an officer to say, okay, I can now understand the pulse of the group because I was in that position and I learned how to follow. And now I know what is required and what the pulse of the group is needing because I've been there before. I think that if you want to be a good leader, you got to know the pulse of the group. And at that point, you have to know when to follow and also when to pick up the mantle.
You know, and to actually maybe circle back to what we were talking about before of, How does the Holocaust happen? Is you have followers that are unwilling to step into that leadership position, either for the group or just themselves, in the moment where it matters probably more than any other time the rest of their lives. And that's an interesting it's an interesting way of that you phrasing it of good leaders know actually how to transition back and forth between leading and following. Like that's maybe that in and of itself is a skill that maybe some people can do more naturally, but that shifting into a leadership position, maybe as human beings, in some sense, every single one of us has to be capable of shifting into being a leader for ourselves, which means saying no when everybody else it might be saying you're supposed to say yes. Mm. And that it can be really hard to do. Actually, so that might be a good segue to that other psychology experiment I referenced earlier. I'm full of them today. You're going to love this.
Send it.
We're not going too long, are we? This is okay.
Oh, no, you're good.
I get so fired up about this stuff. Okay. This is my favorite psychology experiment of all time. So much so, I'm such a nerd. When I was in grad school, I went to a Halloween party dressed as this researcher. And so maybe you've heard of him or not. His name is Stanley Milgram. Have you heard of the Milgram experiments?
Oh, sure have.
Oh.
No, I'm just kidding. I have no idea.
Oh, shoot. Okay. Well, he's one. I mean, it's crazy enough that it's in pop culture a little bit. And so this experiment was absolutely derived out of the idea that there's this Nazi defense of, I was just following orders. You know, you had said that earlier, and it reminded me of this. That. So the question is, like, what does that mean? You know, what are people willing to do if they're just following orders? Like, what won't you do, actually, is sort of the question. So this is a little complicated, but I'll try to explain it. So there's three people in the experiment. There's three people we need to pay attention to. Two of them are in on it. One of them's not. So we have the person running the experiment. He's considered the authority figure. He would be the leader of this group. And he's running the experiment, so he knows what's going on. There is the subject. They're considered the teacher. That's their role in this experiment. And they're not in on it. They're the person off the street who said, yeah, I'll sign up for a psychology experiment. You're going to pay me $4 to do this. I'll do it. This is in 1961, by the way, in Yale. They have no idea what's going on. There's a third person. They know exactly what's going on. They're in on it, but they're pretending like they are also a subject. So in the world of psychology and psychology studies, it's what's called a confederate. It means like you're acting like you're a subject, but you're helping run the experiment. And their title is called the learner. And so all three of them go into this room and the experimenter walks the learner and the teacher over to this chair. And they say, okay, the learner who's in on it, you're going to sit in this chair. We're going to strap you into these electrodes. And we're going to have this other guy, the subject, he's going to read you some questions to test your memory. If you get them right, we're going to go to the next question. If you get it wrong, we're going to shock you. And every time you get one wrong, we're actually going to turn up the voltage a little bit. And they actually had, this is how like sadistic they were. By the way, you can't do a study like this anymore. It's illegal. the person who's not into it, the teacher, they said, oh, you want to see what the shock is like? Here's it at minimum voltage. And they would actually like shock them. And so they could see it. So the learner who's in on it sits in the chair. They get strapped in. The chair isn't actually electrocuting anybody. It's all fake. And then the person running the experiment walks the teacher to the other side of the room where there's a wall that's blocking where their learner is sitting in the chair. So he can't see them, but they're in the same room and he can hear them and everything. And he says, okay, teacher, you sit down in this chair. And in front of him is this metal box that has this dial and a button. And the dial is it's like an old radio dial, if that makes sense, where you can kind of go from one end to the other with this needle. And at one end is 0 volts, and at the other end is 450 volts. And each 100 volts has a little label underneath it. So the first 0 to 100 is called like shock. And then the next section, 100 to 200, is called like painful shock. And then the third one is like severe shock. And then 450 volts is called, what is it called? Like extreme dangerous shock, and then it has three X's next to it, which like suggests danger or death. And then, so he says, okay, here are these questions. There's the memory questions you have to ask the guy. If he gets it wrong, you have to shock him and then move it up 25 volts and then read the next question. Okay. So the guy starts it. And remember, the guy who's getting shocked isn't really getting shocked, and he's in on it. So he keeps getting them wrong on purpose. He gets a couple right, but he keeps getting them wrong. Then the voltage goes, starts going up, and the guy, the actor, starts like saying, ow, that really hurts. And it keeps progressing to where he's like screaming in pain, and it gets up to like 300 volts. And at some point, I forget where it was, he actually stops making noise, almost like he had a heart attack or something. And the guy, the subject, the guy we're really interested in, what are you going to do, has to keep going. Now, if he says to the guy running the experiment, if he looks up and he goes, hey, man, should we keep doing this? Because it looks like he's really in pain or he's not responding. The only thing the experiment can say at that point is, please continue the experiment. That's all. He's got a script. He's got to follow it. If the guy shocks him again, and then the subject, he protests and he says, hey, you know, this guy, this isn't right. We can't keep doing this. The next thing he says is, it is necessary that you continue the experiment. If he protests again, he would say, you have to continue the experiment. And then if you protest a fourth time, then the experiment's over. We don't continue. Everything's done. So the big question is, what we all want to know is, how far did people take it? How far does the random person, how far are they willing to go where contextually it looks like you are putting somebody in extreme danger and potentially killing them? And the answer is 68% of people will do it.
Jeez.
68%.
That's insane.
And that is there. It now, we should add some contextual value or some context here. This is at Yale. The experiment, like the guy has to go to Yale. So he's going on, this is 1961. Like, you know, academic institutions have a reputation, and the guy's wearing a lab coat. It's like, hey, this guy's supposed to know what he's doing. If he's telling me I should continue, I'm supposed to continue. So it would be really hard to say no. But you're literally doing something to kill somebody. I mean, this is the equivalent of, hey, guess what? Nazi private, you got to take this guy back and you got to shoot him. And 68% of people will do it. Now, there's some interesting variations of the same study. And so I actually was just looking this up. If somebody else was in the study where they had to administer the shock, so the sub, and they're in on it. So the subject just says, he reads him the memory question. If he gets it wrong, he tells this other guy, hey, you got to shock this guy. The number goes up. 92.5% of people will go all the way to death.
Wow.
So one step removed. Yeah. I mean, that's nuts. That's the guy who, remember the third group and the of the platoon? The third group, it's like, well, hey, I'll march you into the gas chamber, but I'm not going to push the button. Or I'll round you up from your apartment and take you to the back field, but I'm not going to pull the trigger. If they took the experiment, instead of doing it at Yale, they did it in a different part of the town that's like, let's dilapidate it. It was a dilapidated building. It was a mess. It lowered the credibility, and 48% of people would continue the experiment. If the teacher and the learner can see each other, so it's not behind a wall where you can hear them, but you can see them, it drops to 40%. I'll skip the rest. There's one more that's interesting. So if the experimenter gave the instructions over the phone to the person, so they're not in the room, but they just say, hey, you're supposed to continue the experiment over the phone, it drops to 21% before people will say, enough is enough. I'm not going to do this anymore.
Wow. That's crazy. It kind of makes me allude to, like, you know, online people talk crap, but in person, most don't. You know, a lot of things happen in person that you normally would not do. But what's also crazy is the credibility of, or the appeared credibility of the person asking you to do the task.
Yeah. And this is a stranger too. This is not somebody you have to have in your life the next day. So actually this is, can I tell another story? I know we're running long.
Oh, good.
So when I was an undergrad in psychology, I had all kinds of psychology classes, and in, you know, part of, you learn all these studies, like they talk about them, you're tested on them. And after a while, there's crazy, there's another study real quick. They basically had a group of people and they said, we're going to do a vision test. And it's like seven people are doing the vision test at the same time. Everybody's in on it except one person. And the other six people are told, hey, we're going to put multiple lines up on the screen. And then there's an, and then you have to match them to the line that would be the same length. It's super easy, right? Which line is closest to this one, A, B, or C? The six people who are in on it are told to say, get the wrong answer. Like, you guys all say B, even though it's wrong. And then we want to see what the person who, we want to see what the subject says. So it's like, how, is this person going to tell the truth? Or are they going to look like, are they going to go against the group publicly? And 75% of people will say the wrong answer on purpose.
Oh my gosh.
How long is this line? Which one's longer? And 75% of people will purposefully say the wrong one because they don't want to look, they don't want to be ridiculed in public. Anyway, so all that to say, I'm taking all these psychology classes and you hear about these studies and you think, what are these people doing? Like, what is wrong with you? Why don't you even know this is an experiment on you? Like, why don't you just tell the truth? This is ridiculous. So part of my degree required me to be a participant in some psychological studies. And so,
oh my goodness,
I get called into this room and I'm with 12 people. I'm one of 12. And they say, hey guys, guess what? You're going to be a mock jury for this trial. And I'm like, this is amazing. This is awesome. Usually all the studies that usually people do are just like filling out a survey. So to get this one is like a gold mine of interesting stuff.
Nice.
So they say, okay, well, we're not going to do a mock trial, but you're going to read the transcripts of this trial, and then we're going to act like you're debilitating it as a jury, and we're going to film everything, and we're just going to see what happens because we want to know what happens inside of a jury room. So I read the script. It's basically the premise of what happened is the guy's on trial for murdering his wife. And the story is the police kick in the door. They see him sitting on top of his wife's body. The knife is in his hand. It's dripping with blood. And he's like screaming at her, like, you know, profanities or something like that. I can't remember. Essentially, it's obvious he did it. There's no question. So I read it. Everybody finishes reading the story. We all have the same story. And somebody says, okay, well, let's take a vote. Great. Everybody, they say, all right, who thinks he's guilty? I do. I'm raising my hand for anyone who can't see. I think he's guilty. I'm the only one of the 12 that raised my hand. And I am in disbelief. Like, what are you guys talking about? How? And then I'm like, did you guys read the same story? This is a joke. And they're like, no, you know, and they're coming up with these reasons why they think he didn't do it. And I'm arguing, Eric, this is supposed to be an hour. I went for 4 hours with these people trying to convince them how insane they are for thinking, like, what is wrong with you? This guy, like, everything about this is guilty. And finally I said, I remember saying literally, you guys are wrong. I'm hungry. I'm going to go eat lunch. Fine. He's not guilty. And then it was over. So, and that was it. That was my experience. So I tell this story once in a while to, like, you know, as I hang out with a therapist or something. And I'm telling the story like 10 years later. And my wife looks over at me and she goes, you know, everyone was in on it but you, right? And I was just like,
wow,
what? Oh my gosh, that makes so much sense. How did I not know that till now? That they were all Confederates. They were all in on it, trying to convince me to see how long I would last. And I'm so, I do this for a living. And I wasn't smart enough to figure out that this wasn't some kind of setup. And anyway, so I always think that's funny because I always, I read these studies and I think, why would you kill somebody? why wouldn't you just say no? And I'm telling you, it's different when you're in the moment. It's just different. Wow. Until you're in that moment where you have, I'm just assuming, but if you've got a guy from Yale in a lab coat telling you, please continue the experiment, you may be sitting at home thinking, I would not do it. But the reality is 68% of people will. And that's a lot higher than, there aren't 68% of this audience listening to this podcast right now that are thinking, oh yeah, that's me, I'll do it. Probably 100% of them are thinking, or most of them are thinking, I wouldn't. I would hope anyway. And so the point of this is, you're more vulnerable than you think you are. And to circle back to what you're saying, we need to be thinking of, you can't always be a follower, that you have to step up and be a leader. You need to lead other people when you see something that's wrong, or you need to lead yourself and you need to say no, or you need to stand up to for the guy that's being shocked and say no. And maybe, and and again, in Germany, the people who said, I'm not going to do this anymore, nobody really ever had significant consequences for doing that. And that doesn't mean that you won't in other circumstances, but that maybe you're afraid of the circumstances that you think they're worse than they really are. And that's the hardest part to overcome, is I'm afraid to say I won't do this, thinking all these bad things will happen. And maybe you're making it worse out than it really is.
You know, and this is actually a great point to actually kind of bring things to a conclusion, is, and kind of leave the listener with that thought of, like you said, nobody remembers the guy that just followed the orders, or the girl that just followed the orders and went against their morality and what was right. Nobody remembers them. History doesn't remember them. History remembers the heroes who stand up for what's right in the face of adversity and stand up and say, I don't care what you guys are saying and saying it's right. It's wrong. And you stand up and you stand for what you believe in, and pointing out something that is blatantly wrong or evil.
Yeah.
History remembers those people. Those are the heroes that we write about, that we remember. And I kind of like to quote Gladiator, but where he says, what we do in this life echoes for eternity. And so, kind of leaving that listener, for those who are listening, you have a responsibility to stand up for what's right, to take a stand and say, hey, I don't believe what's happening. Even if you're alone, you know, there are a lot of people who did the wrong thing in World War II and all of our past wars, but there's the people that we remember, the ones who stood up, and even if it cost them their life, those are the people that we remember throughout history. Mm-hmm. So yeah, man, I think honestly, we got to have a third episode, because I know you got more stories to come in. But yeah, man, I just wanted to really say thanks again for sharing all of your insights and some of those studies that you've gone through and your opinions on all of this stuff. Because I think honestly, the mind is the most powerful tool that we have. And it's the one thing that can't be taken away from us. You know, your life can be taken away from your freedom, but nobody can take away what you believe in. And at the end of the day, that is stronger than anything else, than any other force in the world. So, yeah, man.
Yeah. Yeah. We're all a part of the community of human obligation. And yeah, usually it's not saying, no, I'm not going to commit genocide. It's usually much, much, much smaller than that. It's standing up for somebody who's vulnerable that needs help in some way. It's, you know, not like it's one thing. You're participating through by being complicit if you're watching bullying happening. Nothing gets me riled up more than watching other vulnerable people get bullied. Like, that gets under my skin faster than anything. And I think, like, that's a more realistic Milgram experiment. What do you do when it's just so easy to do nothing? And yeah, surround yourself with people with integrity, that people like Eric that would do something,
man, and like you. So yeah, man, for those who are listening, if you know of somebody like that in your life, or you know of circumstances that you may be in currently, take a stand, stand up for the people who can't stand up for themselves, be the person to say, I am not for this. And also don't be the one that's silent,
yeah,
because that makes you equally complicit. Yep. But yeah, awesome. Well, if you are looking to go train and get some training and become a better prepared citizen, go check out our website. Also, if you got something out of this, please go follow the Spotify channel as well as YouTube and Instagram, and hit us up. We'd love to talk to you. If you have any questions about anything or have a question for Brian, reach out to us and we will make sure that he gets that question. Yeah. So
cool.
Awesome, Brian. Thanks again for coming on. And yeah, we'll have to have you on again.
Cool. Thanks, buddy. See you.